Good evening, folks. My name's Henry Farini, and really happy to have, you know, John, Nancy, and Rufus here. The way we're going to do it this evening is John's going to start it out. Nancy Hewitt will be up second, and then Rufus will be up third. So let me just have some short introductory passage here about John. John Ronan is a poet, playwright, movie producer, and journalist. In 1999, he received the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship for Poetry. In 2009, John published Marrowbone Lane. He's a former poet laureate of Gloucester and remains committed to the importance of poetry in civic life. His plays include The Yeats Game and Tees of Eden. Way back in the not-yet-digital age in 2001, he introduced an e-book, one of the first, and called it Damned If I Dotage, a comical tribute to the trials of aging. John is also a founder of a media production company, a teacher of film, award-winning children's author, and creator of a television interview show called Writer's Block, and if anybody is from Cape Ann or the surrounds, they know about it. For 25 years, Writer's Block has brought hundreds and hundreds of writers to talk about their craft and read their work, and we're happy to have John here to read his work. So, John.
Yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, as you know. Some of you are still wearing green. I'm going to start out with a couple of poems with Irish connections from the book that Henry just mentioned, Marrowbone Lane, available on Amazon and at the Cape Ann Museum. I don't have any extra copies myself. I'm going to read from this book because the title is from an actual lane, a street in Dublin. And I'm going to read the poem in which Marrowbone Lane appears, called Lost in the Liberties, Dublin. The Liberties were a kind of a rundown area in Dublin, slummy. It's where the Guinness Brewery was, the first big Guinness brewery. It's since been gentrified. This is Lost in the Liberties, Dublin. Charlton, a crucifix, chips. Bono thrives. The crowd throbs. In ghost getting smoke, soccer sides, widening wives, a priest pushing the pledge, hookers, a drunk druid, blow-ins from rain, the coffer-dammed dark. A register rings. Coins and voices ring. Guinness gilded the old-timers flapping foam over poets and Plunkett, Joyce, Jack, the cup, the guiding ideas, pride in a pint and dying. I'm after a solo hike to Viking sites, Kilmainham, the bullet-blasted P.O., the crypt at St. Michael's, where a nun, a knight, and footloose crook lie exposed, undeniably biting dust. And so, lost. The old man points my way. Marrowbone Lane to Cork. R.D. Street to the Coombe. Flinging foam with his gestures, the glad grace of asparagus. Pleased with my presence, touched by his own. The box shuffles Sinatra for you too. The wizard winks, teeth staccato, beard blackened by ash. You've time for a pint. I do. This second poem is also an Irish themed poem. It's titled Man Crossing a Field, Cashel, and it's based on a painting, so it's sort of what's the term I want? The frastic poem, except the painting's imaginary. But it's based on an imaginary painting, and you'll get the picture from the painting. Man crossing a field, Cashel. In the foreground, size and time. A farmer walks to a cow or pint appointment, ignoring cathedral and tower, orders of arch. Nothing needed, man's the measure of history, making the rock the cairn of Cashel a pub impediment, illusion. And yet the farmer too has stayed in frame, marking silence and slow time, himself become like stone, stately, a second foolish ruin. The fix fails, trompe l'oeil of lasting. Cashel can no more save than canopic canvas. Better a slate in the graveyard, tabloid tilted by wind and drink, than art, effigy kings, the desperate care that makes an act of sadness, neglects a cow or stout for an empty field. That is a sonnet, by the way. Some people have said that sonnets are where retired professors go to die. But I like to use sonnets, especially not Shakespearean usually, but certain forms of sonnets can be made useful, I think. Two poems already have mentioned death, and you have to, if you're in the Writers' Union, the Poets' Union, you have to mention death within the first couple of minutes of any reading. And I've done that now, so I'm going to read a light poem. This is called Lex Julia De Adulteriis, which means the Julian law concerning adulterers. And this is based on facts concerning the law. Ancient family value law damned adultery, passion's sacrifice of lineage to libido among highbrow and noble Romans. Angry parents could kill their own daughter and her peckish patrician. Cuckolds might kill the man and spare the spouse, but must, as good citizens, sue for divorce the wench wife or be flogged as pimps in collusion. Usually, the woman forfeited one-third of her domestic portion, dowry as well, and was banished to one of the farthest islands. Mr. Promiscuous, lucky to be alive, lost half his possessions, and was also sent to a distant island, though the text of Julian's imperial law sagely states, not the same island. There's a poem of Seamus Heaney's called Shelf Life, and in it he talks about five or six items on a shelf in his office and meditates on them separately. And he's using these objects as prompts for his poem, and I use his poem as a prompt for a poem of mine based on three objects sitting on my windowsill. And this poem is called Windowsill, and there are three sections: quartz, still life with apples and pomegranates, and Pharaoh. I've brought visual aids. This is the quartz. And I'm going to put it here. This is the still life with apples and pomegranates. I borrowed these from my windowsill just about an hour ago. This is from 1847, I think. It's Courbet. It hangs in the British Museum, or the National Gallery, not the British Museum. This is Pharaoh. Oh. I think it's Pharaoh. It's kind of hard to see because he's a little small. So those are the three objects from the windowsill that I use as prompts for this poem. Number one. Quartz. From 4 feet, you can imagine candy. A lemony tease that turns cruel closer. Rock found in the Mojave. A common quartz, the hard mineral used for marbles. The semi-precious jewelry trade. Or a cat's whisker to scratch in the early years of wireless, raising Chicago, St. Louis, Pittsburgh. The central flaw or inclusion that implies ghosts and the veiling mist of ritual is simply a function of refracted sunlight. Your anxious gaze, the indifferent crystal. Silicon dioxide, locked in hexagons by the strict physics found in nature, without magic or hints of incense, and unrelated to food, beauty, the future. Still life with apples and pomegranate. 13 apples are arranged in the chipped bowl, skins bruised and pitted, shaded from ripe red to green, all surrounded by shadow. The pomegranate's foreground, a symbol perhaps of creativity or passion or time, perhaps not. Given Courbet's candid realism and the bleakness of Sainte-Pélagie, any prison, any oubliette. A pewter coffee pot's left, recessed behind the stacked apples. Odd positioning for everyday use, but chosen cleverly for symmetry of shadow, the sake of the painting, which hangs now in London at the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square, a tribute to the artist's broad importance and more imposing than a postcard. 3. Pharaoh. Pharaoh's an inch high, one of a million figurines formed in identical likeness and lesson. Sword and headdress, shoulder pads, apron. His Majesty's ready for the Met. The base aria, behold a god, son of Amun-Ra, pumped by pedigree, pyramid power, the orchestra. Nothing matches ancient Egypt for sheer side. Empires of grain and gold, cheerful solar boats, burials with bread and beer. Pharaoh's unaware of the windowsill or pint size, mascot status in deflecting meter and wise guy rhymes, the fear in a pomegranate, Pittsburgh, pride. I'm going to take these because I'll forget them. They've got to go right back on the windowsill tonight, because if they're not there in the morning, I'll have a complete breakdown. I'm going to read another light poem. This is called The Reason for Lisa, and it refers to the Mona Lisa, or in French, as she's known, La Joconde. And I remember being at the Louvre a few times, but several years ago, I wanted to see the Mona Lisa again. And you can't get near it because there's always a huge crowd. And so I didn't try to get near it. I'd seen it before, and I'm actually not super impressed by it. So I looked around that room to see what else was in the room at the same time. And the result was this poem. Catty-cornered from La Joconde and her star-struck fans, there hangs La Chasse de la Puce, courtesy of Giuseppe Crespi, Baroque Bolognese, and the Louvre's droll direction. Here, a woman's flopped on a bed, legs loose. She's scratching generous breasts hidden by homespun. The enigma's if she'll find the flea. Nobody's breathless but me. There's a painting you're all familiar with. You've seen it in many duplications, many copies. It's in Chicago at the what's the museum in Chicago?
Chicago Art Institute.
At the Art Institute. Yeah, thank you. It's called Nighthawks, mm-hmm. And it shows three or four people at a diner really late at night. The woman's modeled on Hopper's wife. And this is imagining what's going on in that scene. Nighthawks. A lawyer, left, shuns his cup for the water glass, wishing it whiskey. The salesman's serious, smoking, talking. Coconut Grove, DeRosa, Pearl, double sawbuck, says the war won't last another year. He knows. served in the big one, Bellow Wood. If that. Soda jerk, clearing the counter. Yeah, uh-huh, yep. Where's Red? Staring at a stub from the pictures, or maybe a matchbook, free hand over so Mr. Serious can touch her painted nails. Blondie Lombard, a funny stuff flick, then gangsters and gunplay. Bending the ticket back, about to snap, or matchbook, maybe, she lit his cigarette. Hopper's humor has her fiery red against yellow and green. Suits a pair of the darkness. A part of the darkness, excuse me. A guy who's gone, all in low-key, hideous light. The dish. It's hot. Real hot. The gunsel. Hold it closer. The dish. Quick. You'll get burned. It's a poem that's based on a true incident of a rat dying somewhere in a house that I had a number of years ago, and trying to find a rat or a dead mouse in the house after it's been dead for a little bit is absolutely necessary and very, very difficult because they're little animals. I finally found it, and this poem is the result. The Habits of the Rat. The odor's beyond sweet, but begins there like skunk. A dead giveaway, rat like a pall, belly full of yellow pellets. We nosed it in the stove, between the immaculate outer wall and oven, this harbinger of evil and disease, opposite of Robin's, decay accelerated by a baking day. The hands and feet were familiar from tracks on pans. The tail told the species, least dragon. Brooding over a treasure of tinfoil bits, pieces of potholder, one marble, and asbestos insulation kneaded like pillows. Perfect. Imagine. The rat wakes to bacon and eggs, gazes at the soft glow of flame, and speaks as fabulous animals can. What a warm house I've found for the winter, rubbing the cat's eye like an amulet. My wife just gave me the signal that I'm at 15 minutes and I wanted to, so I'm going to read two more poems. One is called On the Ubangi River in West Africa. My son Ben mentioned that he was on the Ubangi on Christmas Day in 1995. He worked for the CDC and he was in the Peace Corps and he does a lot of exotic traveling. And something happened on that particular Christmas Day that had nothing to do with where he was, but had to do with our culture. And I mixed the two phenomena and came up with this poem, On the Ubangi. Guides pulled and guests paddled. The bareback crew working currents as the rest of us stroked slowly, wake and water snakes trailing our canoe on the broad Ubangi, border of Congo and a former French colony, La République de l'Afrique centrale, 5 desperate degrees above the equator. The shortwave radio crackled static. Snow in the Dakotas, season's greetings, and on Christmas, Dean Martin has died. Tourists toasted with palm wine, the voice, the Rat Pack, Vegas, a fond belief in blues and crooning, remote as we were on a river in Africa. The first morning we had pushed into mist, splash followed by the splash of crocodiles on the tributary Mumbu. Second morning, a portage past rapids and the start of a week on the big river west of Kemba, mud and a mile wide. Many hours passed without hailing another dugout. Then suddenly, dozens would appear near the next village where we'd stock up on water and wine, either bank of the bending river, or if the radio warned of rebels in Congo, the next north, hugging the Republic. A post office and goats, gusts of children, chickens, a mission, a mosque. Gab was animated in the tavern. Our topics, Christmas, Amore, and small arms. The guides would buy cassava bread and fish and bake the fish on the bank, saying grace by day to Le Seigneur, by night in Sango to Mahogany and the Moon. Ooh. I like that poem. I'm going to close with a poem about a squirrel that begins in Gloucester and ends up in on the West Coast. I've often wondered how far squirrels could go jumping from tree to tree. And this, which is absolutely true, this poem is absolutely true, talks about squirrel travel. It's titled Odysseus, parentheses, or Clint, depending on your cultural attitude. You can think of him as a classical wandering character or sort of an Eastwood Western hero. Around 1842, before clear-cutting, when such events as I'm about to describe were still possible in that age of miracles, Barnum's Thumb, Mormons, countless cures, there was a certain standout squirrel. Squirrels do not have names, albeit they are recognized among their buds, don't even have a cute collective, being solitary, and are simply referred to in the unpretentious plural. Although this particular standout, with a bit of attitude, adventurous spirit, and sly sideways leer, could have been called Odysseus or Clint, if squirrel brains extended to language in the classics, because of the impressive feat foreshadowed above. In October of 42 or 43, Odysseus, or Clint, leaping from tree to tree, naturally netless and never touching ground, traveled from Gloucester, Massachusetts in the Bay State to the San Francisco, California, opposite coast, in 59.4 days, give or take. There was plenty of food and trees, oaks everywhere, acorns, maples, whirlybirds, between the great oaks. And remember, this is before invasive fungi, so millions of American chestnuts, American elms. Even in the prairie states or territories, Odysseus, or Clint, was able to follow the wooded banks of rivers, as the Missouri and Big Cheyenne, cheating once only when he hopped approximately 20 miles on the also plentiful backs of buffalo near the as yet undreamed of Rapid City, South Dakota. You couldn't do this today because of deforestation, not to mention highways, cars, the hapless honk, harsh blasts not working with squirrels they're so naively used to the woods and can't think to get back from traffic, like us with causation, can't see any other way and therefore die innocently, paws drawn up in the posture of prayer. Then, however, there were no cars and little asphalt, with all those oaks and maples, and hickory, ash, sycamore, walnut, and cherry, beech, in the billions, until you begin to understand the tree as transportation. Nevertheless, some skeptics doubt the veracity of these facts, because they ask, what about water, or birds of prey, the goshawk, the eagle, and mountains, deserts, the inaccuracy of maps? Thank you.
Nancy Hewitt sent me an email and said, I'd like to read up there, and I'm the poet laureate of Swampscott. And I was, at the time, I was thinking of Rufus and John reading together, so I decided, well, let's throw some Swampscott in there as well. So she's here today. Nancy's a clinical social worker, and has a private psychotherapy practice in Salem. She's worked with adolescents, adults, couples, families for over 30 years. And she holds an MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts. And her chapbook, Heard, H-E-A-R-D, was published by Finish Line Press in 2013. So I'd like to introduce Nancy Hewitt. Thank you.
So greetings from the South North Shore. And my chapbook is for sale here, just in case you would like to buy a copy. I'm going to start. I found myself choosing poems that have white in them for some reason. I don't know. So you'll hear some poems featuring white, and also you'll hear Vermont in my reflected in many of my poems, because we spend a lot of time in Vermont, which is where I meet up with my muse most often. To the white outside my window. First to cerulean sky, then to the tin shingles of the barn roof, rusted gray to patchy red to iron, and to all that was once white in the world, snowbanks specked with ash, creased and worn by melt, pockmarked by ice slides off the roof. To the white barn sunk deep in drifts, gray tree shadows moving across its clapboards. Gray dims the white, flickers there. And to the white of these pages, to their fine blue lines of dense matriculated dots, to all the white of the world, for your splayed surfaces, your flagrant desire. Everything I know about white. Caucasian white, the calico cat's white, the white of the notebook page broken by thin blue lines, the veined white quartz of gravestones, the ivory bill of a woodpecker once thought extinct, the white of black and white TV before there was color, white of a poached egg, excuse me, white of an eye compromised by hard living, bright white of a New England clapboard house, so bright it looks like color. The candle's white flame, the hot white center of fire, the white light of lightning, and the white heat of anger splayed against a neon bar sign. The white, sorry, the white place your eyes go to when there's nothing you can have, so you go inside yourself. Harbor it there. The white pages of the books that saved you, the powdered faces of the teachers who saved you, white chalk dust clinging to schoolyard brick, chalk dust drifting down the blackboard, Mrs. Costello writing the true things in her perfect letters, showing you a script as bright as the Milky Way.
We
have to see this water down there. Thank you very much. Okay, so this is my poem about ambivalence. It's called Some Days I Don't Want to Write a Poem. There it is, yeah. Some days I don't want to write a poem. Some days the slow stream of water filling the washer is enough. The satisfaction of sorting whites from brights, high loft from low loft, clothes twisted by the smooth plastic cone in the impartial stainless steel tub. Some days watering the plants is enough, the clear pool on the surface, the threat of an overflow, then the steady ebb, the slow percolation, water meandering through peat, searching for flaws in the medium, the inevitability of gravity. Some days it's enough to watch steam hover at the rim of a teacup, how the sudden air current makes it swirl, then lifts it like a smoke signal. On certain days, a poem would interrupt the tangle of cat legs weaving through the morning, the sun's passage from kitchen to bedroom, bars of noon light falling on the oriental through the slats of a blind, the sleeping black cat's fur transformed to shades of rust and henna. Like a breeze ruffling curtains or soot settling on starched white linen, a poem could derail my orderly thoughts, hooked together like railroad cars. Always an engine, always a caboose, always those nondescript ones, trapped in the middle, carrying freight.
It's another white,
another snow poem, although it was written several years ago during another long winter. So this is a prose poem, and it works by associations, and you'll hear various references to the word pressed as I go through the poem. Pressed. Another January morning, another foot of snow. Arborvitae bowed down with winter's weight. Rhododendron leaves curled tight as cigarillos. Sunk deep in the throes of winter, I hear the steady thrum of snowblowers, the easy lift of pounds of crystalline water into 10-foot snow walls. Blessed be the gasoline engine. Even the snowmobile has its virtues, keeping the incest rate down in remote Vermont villages, socked in for months, cabin fever at its highest pitch. I know a woman who waited 70 years to reveal her rape, not in a remote village, but in suburban Connecticut, when her uncle brought her home early from the family square dance. It happened to her daughter, too, and so on. During the Depression, my mother was pressed into service as a maid, where she discovered the joys of the electric iron, to her everlasting pleasure. In later years, she ironed sheets, underwear, anything she could get her hands on, idle hands, as it were, being the devil's workshop. In the Salem witch trials, the convicted women were hanged, and two men were pressed to death. I once knew a man who had an iron plate of rage, whose voice could press the very air out of a room. Winter in New England can be like this. The airless wait for the first scorching pitch of spring training, sweat remembered on the neck of the bat. This poem is called Completing the Ark, and it has an epigraph by Leonard Cohen, which says, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. A warm front's arriving, blasts of sun knifing their way through thunderous gunmetal clouds. Flames emerge from the hesitant fire, lick the edges of the split wood. Electricity had not come to my grandparents' farm when my mother left home in the early 1940s to work as a maid. And then, tungsten filaments. Imagine the first time she flicked a switch in the college professor's house and saw light playing over furniture she'd polished to a high sheen. Many years later, I saw the slant of light on the empty green bottle of Rolling Rock as it completed its arc from the open Pontiac window to the shoulder of the rural road lined with autumn's pink poverty grass. In those days before cup holders and breathalyzers, before seat belts, my father would have steadied the bottles between his legs and ordered my mother to heave the empties out of sight. That never happened, he said 30 years later. In the velvety folds of your mind, there are desires that lean back in their comfortable chairs, awaiting illumination. Then there's the light you offer up with your words, and how sometimes you turn away first, before the pain of refusal. Okay. And more white, another prose poem. It's called Pure as the Driven. White was blinding in the 50s. Diapers washed in ivory snow, the starched white of nurses' uniforms. The last pillows my mother lay back on were hospital white, that is to say gray, made shiny by institutional pressing. Vanilla ice cream, her last meal, fed to her by a blue scrubs nurse. Head tilted back, mouth opened for each spoonful, hungry as an unfledged baby bird. You're no nurse, she'd flung at me over the years, wanting me to make her better. That's right, I'd reply, never wanted to be. The agreement cementing our distance. Cement, a poured gray white, the patio she'd sweep or push snow from to get to her clothesline. Laundry every Monday, cursing when it rained. Pegging to the line, the wringer wrung clothes, whites hung in direct sun, nature's bleaching agent. When she asked me to help, later, I'd yell back at her from the lawn where I lay slathered with baby oil. To have the whitest clothes, to have the tannest skin. Tuesdays, her whole being bore down on the ironing board, strong hands that had never held a steering wheel, wielding her iron with relentless accuracy, collar and cuffs first, followed by sleeves, then the body. Confidently guiding the tip of her iron into darts, she'd exclaim, "There is nothing like a white blouse, is there?" Focused on the latest infidelity on guiding light, I'd mutter, "There's everything like a white blouse." In the dismissive tone, I'd learn from my father, whose trade was in cement. Construction foreman, builder of bridges, erector of highway signs. On a trip one day years before, I remember watching from the back seat, my mother smiling, reached over to pat his sleeve, wanting both of us to admire his freshly ironed shirt. Ahead of us, cars flew by on an overpass, one of the bridges he'd built. "Dad, you're helping to build America," I said. Her sour tone, "Where'd you hear that?" His big tanned hands on the wheel of the Pontiac. "Thought it up myself," I said, angling for his grin in the rearview mirror. On laundry days, she'd pull his shirts from the hamper and make me sniff them, confirm the scent of another woman. Half a century later, I can still call up that cheap perfume and the clean scent of air-dried clothing. Nothing erases like sun. This poem I wrote recently, and it's after Betsy Scholl, and it's who was one of my teachers in the MFA program, and it's written in couplets, and the title is Genealogy. One of her parents was the sun, the other was a spy. One parent was a branch, the other was a cloud. One parent was a mask, the other a reverie. One parent was a ruler, the other a hem. One parent measured truth, the other measured hope. One parent hit home runs, the other one choked. One parent was a teacher, the other a schemer. One parent was a metronome, the other a crescendo. Neither parent resembled her favorite characters, the ones in novels whom she would follow anywhere. One of her parents was fuel, the other was a flame. One parent was foolish, the other was profane. One parent was soap, the other was lie. One parent was a candle, the other spoke half-truths. One parent was a nursery rhyme, the other the front page. One parent was a church bell, the other a believer. One parent subtracted, the other one divided. The girl had her own way of making calculations. One parent was a Chevy, the other on a mission. One parent burned out while the other one remained. One parent saw the middle, the other the end. Both parents forgot their lines, but then they remembered.
Okay. Two more.
It's called batting practice. This is to take us into spring a little bit. These last two will move us into a better weather frame of mind. Batting practice. Hank Aaron made it out of childhood swinging at bottle caps with a tree branch. If you'd spent much time in the Bronx in the 70s, you'd have seen a young Manny Ramirez running up hills, towing a tire tied around his waist with a rope. Resilience, ambition, belief in yourself. In my mother's family, there were none of these, just resignation. 10 barefoot kids scuffing the farmyard dirt, kicking at chickens. Without shoes, no way out. My mother learned to swing a bat the summer I turned 15, the summer my father began working out of state during the week when she and I played softball with a family next door. New neighborhood, no car, absent husband. All of these sparked the sense of adventure she had then, how we were able to talk her into evening up the teams, the first glow of freedom that follows abandonment. Steamy hot nights lasted forever, the smack of the bat, close calls, lopsided scores, a late trip to Dairy Queen. It's how I want to remember her. Slim, 35, her hair still brown, loosely curled, in her green and white plaid seersucker sundress, and with an even suntan she got from hanging clothes on the line, better than I could get smeared with baby oil, spread-eagled on my beach towel on the lawn. Still wearing lipstick, she crowded home plate, a lefty, in her beige, strappy sandals, her toenails, fire engine red. One of the boys nicknamed her Phyllis Diller, capturing her wackiness in those days when she could still be teased, even laugh at herself when a pitch twirled her around in a circle, the wood bat with a life of its own, pulling her through the thick summer air. And now into, this is for all the gardeners in the audience. It's about the struggle with what you want to grow and what grows anyway. Spell. It happens every year. The big wheel of spring catches you in its cogs, pulls you into its machinery of till, rake, fertilize, and you plant. Bare knees sunk into red-brown earth, fueled by the drum of grass in the woods, by the distant knock of a woodpecker on an ancient maple. You close your eyes and see just you and the head-bowed Solomon seal together all the livelong day and vow to combat the seditious blue fescue, the wily crabgrass, the raspberry canes that come crawling from their own bed. You pledge your vigilance to stop their invasion and that of their consorts this year as never before, marveling at the way aches and pains make similar inroads into your crouched, kneeling body. You promise to be kind to this selfsame body, especially to your spine, which wintered over on your forgiving couch and now resents its nearness to this pebble-strewn soil. Weeds in a tilled garden, as easy an affiliation as hands and knees to earth. The promise of life by your own hands drives your labor, so you toil, then fret. Marauding deer, voracious insects, viruses with unpronounceable names, and while Astilbe and Campanula grow strong, so also does the underground nexus of rye, purple vetch and the common Queen Anne's lace, until one day you look away and there is no turning back, the tide of the unwanted, and you will have lost the fight again. If only you'd not lost your footing, if only you'd not fallen under the spell of the crimson poppy, nodding in the waxy midday sun with its black, many-eyed center.
Our next poet, Rufus Collinson. I don't know anybody who calls you Ruth Ann. There must be a couple people.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I've been called Rufus since I was
5. So there she is back there, Rufus, since she was 5, a lifelong resident of Gloucester, and she's worked as a publication director of Project Adventure for 27 years. And she is the author of 2 volumes of poetry. Turning the Stones, published in 1997, and Traveling to You, published in 2008. She's worked as a journalist, a bookkeeper, and a turkey farmer. And I haven't yet had a conversation with Rufus about her being a turkey farmer, but I hope to do so soon. And maybe you do, too. During her 4-year tenure as Gloucester Poet Laureate, she hosted numerous public readings in this room. And there was a lot of energy that came out of those readings. And we're real happy to have her back to read for us. So, Rufus.
How are you all? Does anybody need to stretch or use the potty or anything? You've been sitting for a while. You're okay? Okay. Okay. Well, the first poem I'm going to read, I had the most wonderful friend who always was here with me. His name was David Demain, and he died unexpectedly 2 years ago, but his spirit still lights my world, and so I wanted to read this first one to him, for him. For David, every morning when you were able, you walked the road to the ocean to stand open-armed and greet the rising sun, the sun envious of your rising love. Later in the day, as you walked again on Shore Road, neighbors would dash from their houses to enter your light, which began with sunrise, but then was transformed by the goodness of your being. Again and again, you have filled us with your light, and remembering you, we will shine. Okay. Gee. Okay. This first one is a little bit, as Henry said, I was born at Addison Gilbert, and I've lived here forever. And this is kind of about when you live in the same place. Jumping in. I was 12 years old, dreaming already of the life within life, writing plays and poems, clumsy beyond description, when I arrived at Central Grammar School, to a daily journey over the bridge, learning about the universe of Gloucester from my new friends, learning art and history and language from my new teachers. What I will never forget is the lesson I learned from the kind 8th-grade girls on the playground. In elementary school, I fell down every day at recess playing jump rope, trying to jump in. My new friends at Central Grammar taught me to look up, to wait until the rope swung high, to wait for the thin shimmering line to reach its highest arc, to enter then and begin to keep the rhythm. And here I am today. The school has become a residence for elders, and once again, I am learning to jump in. I think I live in the old music room. Okay, this is called The Watched Pot. It had been a long afternoon of aloneness when I put the pan of water on the stove to boil. At first, there is just the slight sound of change, and then the collection of crystalline bubbles at the bottom of the pan, hundreds of perfect orbs gathering, bouncing, becoming a sphere of waves and light and purpose, reminding me again of all that is possible within a day. Okay, this one has a little bit of a funny ending, but it's true. May I have this dance? Last night, I dreamed of dancing with Daddy. My father was a staid old Finn, a stonemason who moved slowly, carefully through his days, releasing the shapes he saw within the stones, constructing walls like roving sculptures, taking pride in a life of perfect seams. In the dream, I approached him with open arms. His ancient eyes sparkled as we worked the room. The two of us as graceful now as we always had been awkward before. Tonight I sat on the stoop and looked up to the sky, smiling again at the notion of dancing with Daddy. He looked down with a wink, I know he did, and said, I'll be practicing. I promised that I would too. Practicing. The very next day, driving out of town on a shimmering September morning, my mind tumbling with the usual lifts and drifts, I saw a man standing on the sidewalk facing the traffic. An old man with a baby face, smiling wide and giving a thumbs up to each passing driver. Without thinking, I pulled over, got out of the car, took him in my arms, and I began to lead. It's true, I really do. I see him still sometimes. He always smiles at me and waves. This is about, I'm sure, what you all have experienced. Just driving in your car past all the homes, driving at night especially, the lights in the windows. It's called Life Behind Lit Windows. Called upon again to drive. The air is cold in my blue van as the night without. Dinner left behind to its own heat, the cranky engine warms. I settle back and look for life behind lit windows. Taking the curves wide, I search kitchens for steam. Blue rooms, amber rooms, upstairs windows shining bright. Edge of cupboard, glimpse of portrait, rows and rows of colored books. Sometimes whole rooms appear with such luster of light, such perspective of nook and beam, that I can see back and back. Tablefuls of celebration, alcoves of despair. Tonight, I'm just a tired driver, taking comfort in the hour of safe return. People come home, preheat the oven, take a bath, admire the suspension of spirits in a crystal glass, drink them in. Mm-hmm. I always wonder what's happening in people's houses as I pass by. This is called Fern Fever, and it won't be too long before we see ferns. Fern Fever. I want to curl up like a caterpillar and sleep inside a fiddlehead, safe within the tendril green, swathed in cotton, soft as mist. aching deep in fetal fronds, wondering what to be, until an upward surge of turgid strength unfurls a woodland fern, magnificent and tall, dropping me like its samara to the fragrant earth. And then I would be a flyer, gliding low over groves of shining leaves, on new wings, slight and brilliant, dipping way inside all the waving flowers. And before the ferns, probably, forsythia. I actually thought I saw some today. Oh, my God. Oh, forsythia. Common yellow canes of spring arch in spindles through fences, spill over alewife brooks, hedge front yards of shuttered houses, flounce a tango in the woods along the road. As a girl, I heard for Cynthia and imagined a rangy Yankee peddler roaming every town, tossing bright seeds in memory of his first love. And this is one that I wrote while looking out from the boulevard where I go every day. And hope you'll stand and look out with me. Water over stones. This morning, the ravenous sea reaches way out over the shore and pulls back again, powerfully driven to contain itself. I hear the hall of water over 100,000 stones. Oh, the sound of longing. Hush, rock, hustle, huddle, huddle, hush. The crockery and the surge. Water taking the shape of stones. This great symphonic jostling of all that comes in, of all that pulls out, of all that remains. Let's see. Oh, already read that one. Clementine of the year. Do you love clementines? I just think they're so delicious. Clementine of the year. I open the fruit slowly. It's all here. The precious moment, the lost aroma, the local honey, the sweet zip. And I am home again with you. Each segment a gift of life, an hour in Valencia, an awareness of lips and juice and shine. Oh, my darling. Oh, I think I might have more supermarket poems than the average poet. Express line. In the express line today, the shoppers are irritated by the hired helper of the old woman who is perpetually baffled. The young helper with the brusque manner loads 15 more items than the 10 that are allowed. Everyone in line sighs and shifts and mumbles, both at her indulgence and her lack of kindness to her confused and tottering charge. When suddenly, the lovely Asian woman at the end of the line begins to sing, actually begins to sing in the superstore, a perfect soprano accompaniment to the music of the spheres. The old woman turns and smiles widely, recognizing what is beautiful, for a moment recognizing herself. Her face shines a light we are all standing in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really happened. A lot of poetry is, it's just around us. It's a matter of seeing it and being in it, feeling it. For you, being sad, I hope that you wake up slowly today and find a way to smile about just one thing. Remember the exuberance of the last helpless giggle. Build your day around that. The other moments will fall into place like a scuffling little band of children, beloved and hungry. Well, this one. This one's about a bug. Poetry is everywhere. Visitation. Sitting in a slant of morning sunlight, a guest at your table, reading the passage that you have marked for me, I notice that what I thought was a period has begun to move across the huge bright continent of the page. Looking closer, I see that the world's smallest creature is green, or the notion of green, the green within green, the absolute beginning. Leaning way in, I see that this nub of all beginnings has legs, minuscule filaments illuminated by the light that streams from your window. As I watch the procession of my magnificent mentor of the morning, I feel myself grow larger. Weeks later, I will still remember the splendid dot that caused me to fill with this love, this huge and helpless love. And then, this last one for you, traveling to you. It's you I run to with every sighting, every comprehension, every incredulity, every intimation of love. I imagine that one day we will run to one another, the way we once ran up the stairs to home, wild with news. For now, I hope that we meet here in these still small words. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Henry.